17 to order. The complaint committee uses a majority vote of a quorum of the members, and they may go into executive session to obtain legal advice pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A3. On any matters in the agenda, the board reserves the right to change the order of the agenda items except for the hearings. Mr. Blanchard, has there been any requests to?
No, Mr. Chair.
Hearing no change of order, we'll move on to item two, which is the complaint committee meetings, which are the audio recordings, which are now posted, so we do no longer have to accept those. They're up. Ms. Stanfield, are they up?
Yes, they are.
I still need a motion to accept them as the official minutes.
You can do that earlier.
I have a hard time with that.
Okay.
A motion to accept the minutes as the official.
I'll second the motion.
Okay, any discussion? Hearing none, take a vote. Aye?
Aye.
Ayes have it. No nays, no abstentions. Great, moving on to item three of the agenda, non-student complaints. First complaint is number 17-NS501, Arizona Summit Law School, and the complaint is the State Board. Members from the school, please come forward. Please state your names for the record.
Nicole Stanton, I'm counsel for Arizona State Law School.
Kimmy Woolridge, interim dean of Arizona Summit.
Okay, thank you. Would you like to make any statement?
With regard to this.
Oh, hold on, hold on.
Go ahead.
Mr. Blanchard, can you introduce? I'm sorry.
No, would you like me to?
Yeah. Today I would.
Mr. Chair, members of the complaint committee. On December 8, 2015, the determination to open a complaint was presented to the complaint committee. At that meeting, they voted to open a complaint and to monitor state bar pass rates, low LSAT scores, and student loan debt. On November 30th, 2015, at that time, Dean Mays submitted documentation and spoke in front of the committee on December 8th, 2015 in reference to those concerns. A copy of that December 8th report is attached for your review. Since the year went by, board staff reached out to the institution to get some updated information regarding the four criteria that's listed on the complaint summary. And then here to answer any of your questions, as you know, is Nicole Stanton, the attorney for the institution, and Dean Penny Woolridge.
Thank you. Okay, now we'll go ahead.
Sure. With regard to this particular agenda item, I'm going to turn the time over to the dean to fill you in on the bar passage rates in particular.
I sent a letter to the Mr. Blanchard on March 16th, 2017, in response to the inquiry that he had that was sent to me. And I provided information, including a chart that shows predicted bar pass rates. So these are predicted rates based upon cohorts in terms of LSAT scores and grade point averages. One of the things that we know just from studying our own students in the past 10, 11 years is that bar pass rate is really predicted most accurately by the law school grade point average as opposed to the LSAT score. But when you look at the LSAT score, the median LSAT score is the driving number that predicts bar pass. Historically, Arizona Summit has had a fairly high bar pass rate, and we certainly have complied with the 75th percentile for the American Bar Association. But in the years, I believe 2011 to 2015, our entering quartiles were reduced, and at that time, the entering quartiles went from down from a 153 as the top quartile, 150 median quartile, 148 bottom quartile, to a 148, 143, 140. And we believe that that probably had some significance in terms of first time bar pass rate. However, ultimately, our students do pass the bar. With respect to the number of students that have taken the bar historically from Arizona Summit, we believe there's, find that number, approximately 1,600 students have taken the bar in either Arizona or another state, and we have calculated approximately 1,472 have passed the bar either in Arizona or in another state, and some have passed in multiple states. Because now Arizona is what's called a UBE, or Uniform Bar Exam State, and so if you pass the bar in one of the UBE states, you can then be sworn in into the member UBE state by reciprocity. And so we often have students, for example, take the bar in New Mexico. If they score high enough in New Mexico, they have to have at least 273 points on the bar exam, then they would be eligible to be waived into Arizona. So we've been trying to track how many students actually pass the bar in a UBE state outside of Arizona. That's very difficult to do because the state bars generally don't report by names of people who pass the bar. They just tell us you had three students who took the bar in the state, and all three passed or all three fail, that sort of thing. So we're trying to get more accurate information. Most of that information is coming from self-reporting. We have more accurate information with Arizona because it's our home state, and therefore we were able to get more accurate information. Another question that arose from Mr. Blanchard was the legal residency program, I believe that Dean Mays had reported on. The legal residency program is a program that was created to assist students in having an extended period to pass to study and pass the bar. So generally when a student graduates, let's say it's a May graduation, the student has approximately 10 weeks from the time of graduation until the time of the bar exam being, to take the bar exam, because usually the bar exam is in July for a May graduate. Sometimes that's just not enough time for some students to study, and so we created the legal residency program that offers the student an opportunity for extended study, special classes, opportunity to take mock bar exams. They also have an opportunity to have an experiential experience by interning or clerking or working in a law firm or in a law-related job. And that's designed to help them improve their legal analysis, their legal writing, their legal their understanding of various issues of the law. That program has been very successful for us. We've had that program actually for the last couple of years, and it has proved to be very successful for us in terms of not only students who are taking the bar and doing well on the bar after having been in that extended program. Part of that program also includes the opportunity for the students to work one-on-one with bar coaches. And so, for example, in this last bar cycle, the February 2017 bar, every faculty member at Arizona Summit agreed to coach five students and work with them individually on a week-by-week basis to improve their ability to do analysis, to understand the concepts of the law so that they would perform better on the bar exam. The other issue in terms of student loan debt, I believe our cohort default rate currently is 1%. That the latest report we received is 1%. We generally have a fairly decent cohort default rate in terms of loan rate, so that's where we are on that. The other issue that Mr. Blanchard raised was whether or not Charlotte School of Law and their Title IV funding issue affected Arizona Summit, and the answer is no. We're independent entities, and we have not been affected by Charlotte's issue, and the Department of Education has not made any given us any notice or any reason to be concerned about Title IV funding. We appeared at the October the October hearing of the ABA. Actually, Dean Mays appeared at that, and I just recently appeared before the ABA Council of March 11th, 2007. We're waiting for a decision from the ABA Council to determine whether or not we have not been in compliance with any standards that the ABA has set. We have not heard from the ABA as yet.
Okay. Want to start, Ms. Wynn?
Sure. You have the same ownership as the Charlotte School of Law?
Yes.
And so obviously there were things there that are being questioned, which obviously raised some concerns for us. The article that I recently read said that they are going to go nonprofit.
I have no idea what's happening with Charlotte. I mean, I don't know that. I've read that article too, but I'm not a part of their administration. I generally meet with the in a management meeting every week, and I get the same report. And the article you read is the same information that I know.
I believe someone does not have their phone on mute. Could you please do that? We're getting some unusual sounds. Please be sure to not put it on hold, as we will then get your music. Thank you.
Okay, so part of their, so if you read the same article I did, part of the deal is that InfoLaw would pretty much back out in participating in decisions made for the school. If you're allowed to stay, is anything similar happening with you that they're stepping out and giving you as a dean more?
Well, let me just clarify for you in terms of what InfoLaw does. InfoLaw actually provides support services to each of the schools, and I can only speak from the perspective of Summit. I really can't speak from the perspective of Charlotte, but if they are doing the same thing with Charlotte as they are doing with us, then it's probably the same. So they provide support services. For example, they provide some assistance with human resources issues. They provide assistance with statistical information. They provide some assistance with financial management. They provide assistance through legal counsel, although we always have our own local legal counsel, but there are other issues, for example, regulatory issues with either the Department of Education or the ABA, where legal counsel is involved. So they provide support services for us, but decisions about the operation of the law school happens right on campus with the president, the dean, and the leadership team of the school. So that's how it functions without necessarily InfoLaw making it. They don't make any decisions for us.
Okay. Did you perchance read the article about the Busen Cookman Historical Black University in Daytona Beach, Florida?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so you're apparently currently in discussion with them to have
yes.
restaurants
mm-hmm.
again.
Yes.
This is not a flattering article.
Well, there's a lot of articles that are written that are not flattering, but I think that what happens when you have a law school who has been established because of private investors versus a university affiliation, you have unflattering articles. That's a sort of an uphill battle. that we've had to fight for the last 11 years. The Bethune-Cookman affiliation apparently has been in the works for quite some time. There's been discussions going on. There's actually, my understanding, there's discussions with three universities, and Bethune-Cookman was the first university to want to enter into an affiliation agreement. And the affiliation agreement is first a Bethune-Cookman and Summit coming together to determine whether or not Bethune-Cookman would acquire the school. So the affiliation agreement is first. Bethune-Cookman apparently is going to go to their regulatory body for approval. The ABA, American Bar Association, has been notified of the affiliation, and so Summit will be going to the ABA for approval. And upon the approval, then Summit and Bethune-Cookman or another university, because it doesn't have to be Bethune-Cookman, will hopefully enter into an acquiescence agreement. That's my understanding of what's happening with Bethune-Cookman.
How long have you been the acting dean?
January 1, 2017.
Welcome aboard, right? Do you have any school management dean experience?
I have been a member of the law school since it opened its doors in 2005. Prior to that, I was a judicial officer, a judge in the Superior Court for 10 years. Prior to that, I was a private practitioner, and prior to that, I was the assistant director for the Division of Children and Family Services for the Department of Economic Security, where I managed about 1,200 employees and over a $346 million budget. Prior to DES, I was a litigation director at Community Legal Services, where I oversaw about an $8 million budget and about 20 lawyers around the state. And before that, I was practicing in Texas as a managing attorney, and I managed the largest legal services office in the state of Texas with about 25 lawyers, 10 paralegals, 5 secretaries, and about a $10 million budget.
Oh, which is very impressive. But as far as like being administrator at a school, mm-hmm. your association with this school, was any of it in a management capacity?
Yes, I was the academic dean for 2 years.
Okay.
And I've been a member of the president's leadership team, I would say, for the past 5 years.
On your website, well, actually, first, go back to these articles. Being that we license proprietary schools, we're very aware that articles can be intentionally harsh just based on the fact that the school is for-profit. And so I believe that you can certainly trust me and us that when we're reading these articles, we certainly know to watch for bias based on proprietary schools. And so my concern with the articles was the pass rate. And you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know how important it is for students to pass the bar the first time versus taking it a second time. So I really can't judge, right, but we can compare.
Well,
and so comparing the
right.
different schools, you know, like you know, ASU was at 77%, the statewide was 64% the first time. So it does give us something to compare to, even if it's not our area of expertise
right.
of the laws.
Right. Well, I think that one of the things when you compare the law schools in Arizona, you have to compare actually the number of people taking the bar at the time versus the pass rate, because we generally have more people taking the bar. But I would also say that the first-time pass rate is not the ultimate indicator. It's actually whether or not someone passes the bar at all. Some people go to law school and they never intend to practice law, so they never even take the bar exam. Some people, it takes them more than one time to pass the bar. Some people have life obstacles that interfere with their ability to study and concentrate so that they can pass the bar. I'll just use myself for an example. I've had a stellar career as a lawyer for over 30 years. Wouldn't do anything else. It's probably the most rewarding thing that I've ever done in my life is to practice law and represent people. And most of my practice has been a service to the public as opposed to private practice. I didn't go to law school to make money. I went to law school to help people. And that's what I've done all my career. My first time taking the bar in Texas, I didn't pass the bar. It's not because my law school gave me a faulty education. It's because when I returned home from Washington, D.C. to study for the bar, I had a terminally ill father and a sister who had a mental health crisis in college. And I was helping my mother trying to take care of those two people. And that interfered with really my ability to study. But I did pretty well. I missed the bar by 3 points the first time around. And what did I do? I just dug in and took it the second time and I passed it.
I understand what you're saying. I understand, but I think the circumstances are a little different. What we're concerned about is the program and the school structure causing the issues of non-pass rate. That's
no, it's not the program.
I think I know that your not passing bar were different circumstances, and I think I don't know what school you went to, but that's the concern we have is this systematic of
what I would like to direct you to is a study that was done by the American Bar Association about bar pass rates and people of color. And one of the things that we have done with in our school since we first opened the door is we wanted to be a school of inclusion, not exclusion. Most law schools set their LSAT scores, entering scores, so high that oftentimes people of color cannot become members of the bar, cannot even get into law school. And we don't want to do that. We live in a state where 40% of the population are people of color, but less than 8% of the population are members of the bar. Less than 2% of the state are African Americans. When I came to Arizona in 1987, there were 25 African American lawyers in the entire state. I knew them all by heart. Now there's about 300. So we've gotten a little better in almost 30 years. But 300 in 30 years, that's a paltry number in my mind. When you start looking at that and you compare that to overrepresentation of kids of color in the juvenile justice system, overrepresentation of people of color in the criminal justice system, lack of judicial officers. I was appointed as the first African-American judge on the Superior Court of the state of Arizona, African-American female judge. I retired in 2005 to help found Arizona Summit. And guess what? There has not been another African-American woman judge appointed to the Superior Court since 2005. Why? Because there's not enough applicants in the pool. There's not enough people in the pool for the governor to have the ability to select qualified people for the bench. The same thing, the same numbers are equally present with Hispanic and Asian folks. And so what Arizona Summit is trying to do is trying to change that. The ABA has historically had numerous articles on the pipeline to diversity and what law firms should do and what law schools should do. Arizona Summit is probably one of the only law schools in the country trying to do just what the ABA has asked everyone to do in terms of opening up the pipeline for diversity in the law. And what happens is that when you open up the pipeline, everybody's not going to pass the bar the first time around. It doesn't matter. I mean, when I applied to be a member of the bench, the Governor Hull didn't ask me whether I passed the bar the first time or the second time in Texas or the first time or the second time in Arizona. It was just that I was a member of the bar. When I pull out my bar card looks just like everybody else's bar card. It doesn't say first time passer or second time passer. The key is getting that license to practice law.
I understand that. And I think I speak for everyone when we applaud the mission of what you're trying to do at the school. The question we have is the structure and the school able to fulfill its mission? with attrition the way it is and the pass rates, that's the concern I have, is do you have the structure and processes in place that are going to make these students successful, knowing where they come from?
Yes, absolutely.
And the data is alarming to us.
Yeah, yes. It is.
I mean, it's alarming to us. Don't think that we take this lightly.
Oh, I know.
But
we
absolutely have the structure. We have some of the finest law professors. I think we have a really good team of law professors that have that work beyond the call of duty with our students. Even recognizing the need to remediate with students when they need remediation, identifying and developing specialized workshops and classes that would help the students matriculate. And that carries on into our bar preparation program. So we have a required bar preparation program that the students have to take in their third year. And with that bar preparation program, we give them several mock bars. And what those mock bars do during the class is it identifies for the student what their weaknesses are. And so then when they then move into the bar program, we begin to help them with those weaknesses. So as I was indicating earlier, the five students that I coached last fall and for the February bar, I knew what their weaknesses were in every subject that they tested on the mock bar, and I worked individually with those students on those particular weaknesses. And the only way that you can really shore up people's ability to pass that bar, even on the first time around, is to make sure that those weaknesses that they show in the assessment process, that they're working on those and they're learning the black letter law and they're able to apply that black letter law. And so I think that our foundation and our structure is really is really good at this point.
I'd like to go through your response letter to a certain thing, going back to the demographic question, which again I think Mr. Jacobs said we applaud that for wanting to do that, but again at the end of the day you got to have the results that are required. You do quote the person of color constitute 40% of the population, but only 8% in the legal system. So I ask you, ma'am, what is your demographics? I mean, I'll go pull the iPads or have you provide those to me. But I'd be interested in the
demographics in terms of
racial demographics, diversity.
Mm-hmm. So currently, in our population of students, diverse students, is about 34%. Historically, I would say we have averaged somewhere between 25 to 35%, but last year it was 40%. In 2014, it was 31%. And I believe the predicted diversity numbers for 2017 is going to be about 29 to 30%. We admit students in the fall, spring, and summer, and so we won't have the full diversity numbers for 2017 until after the summer session.
Sure,
starts.
Yeah, you're always working in the past with that. Okay. And then are you guys still doing the program to prep people, LRP?
Yes, the legal residency program, yes.
Okay. How long have you been doing that?
So the legal residency program is a part of the bar prep. So we have we have our own internal bar prep program. We have contracted with Barbary and Kaplan, which are the two most frequently used national bar prep programs in the country. Generally, most students, when they graduate from law school, will take a Barbary program. So we have contracted with both Barbary and Kaplan because we wanted to take the best of both of those programs, and we put together an internal program for our students. The Barbary program and the Kaplan program provides, one, study materials, and we use those study materials. We actually start providing students with study materials in their first year. So there are first year study materials, second year, third year, and then finally the bar prep materials. Each of Barbary and Kaplan have different types of multiple choice questions that go over the core courses or core subjects that are tested on the bar exam. So we pull from those subjects. We also use Barbary and Kaplan graders. The bar exam itself consists of three parts: multiple choice questions, essay questions, and a practice test. And so from each of Barbary and Kaplan, we pull the best of their materials in those three areas. We have live lectures from Barbary that come during the bar prep season to lecture to our students, similar to the commercial lectures that they give for anyone who's taking the bar exam. And we also have specific people from Kaplan who actually grade essays, because the way that the essays are graded for the bar exam, we want the students to experience that exact method of grading so that they can see how their legal analysis is, how their identification of the rules of law and their application to the particular facts of the question. And so they get assessments that are essentially the same as they would get if a bar examiner was grading them. Part of our staff, we have four dedicated people who work on nothing but academic success and bar prep for our students. One of our bar prep personnel is a 20-year person. She's taken, she's taken around 7 or 8 bar exams herself. And so she's considered an expert in bar examination. She was, again, a 20-year employee of Kaplan. And she and another one of the bar coaches who has probably taken 3 or 4 bar exams, they're like experts on bar examination, and we feel like we're providing the best of the best for our students to help them get over the hurdle of taking the bar exam.
That being said, and thank you for the detailed explanation, when a student finishes, I don't believe 100% what I read in articles, because certainly, but there was a lot of quotes about they felt like a program like this was actually the school's attempt to keep them from taking the bar exam. Now, there might be some truth to that, when they're done, they're free, regardless of what you think, they're free to take the bar exam.
Absolutely.
Okay.
One of the things that we identified, and this was actually student initiated, and one of the things we identified is students will come and they will, for example, they may come to me and they may say, you know, professor, I don't think I'm ready to take the bar exam. Well, what we know is that when people apply to take the bar exam, they have to expend somewhere around $15,000 to $2,000 to apply to take the bar exam, the fees for the state bar, and then they come to us and they say, we're not ready. But they don't have the money, they can't get a refund on their money. And so one of the things that we developed before we developed the legal residency program is we offered students, well, if you don't want to take the bar exam, we will pay your fees for you to sit for the next time. And so the article comes out with a negative viewpoint of that. Here we are trying to do something good for students. I mean,
it's gonna, you're gonna get some of that. You just get there, especially when you got for profit in front of your name.
Right.
It sounds like it's an RF program. Just so I understand, first time riders are the first time you take the bar, right?
Right.
Repeat riders are when
So
your trend is going downward. It looks like in February, do you know what your February 17 numbers are looking like?
Not yet. The results don't come out until May. We're trying to be optimistic about February 17 because we gave several mock bars in our bar prep program. And in our mock bar program, I believe we had the highest, in our final mock bar, we had the highest score that we've had in the last several years. So we're really trying to be optimistic about those who are sitting for the bar this time.
Okay. What is your current student population?
We're about 277 now.
277. You said you had 4 people helping with bar bar prep exams?
Yes,
so
4
really
people. Four people as dedicated to bar prep and academic success, but 18 other faculty members who also assist as well. So if you were to add it all together, it's really 22 people helping those 200.
Four full-time dedicated.
Dedicated, yes.
How many students attempt to graduate?
This coming May, we will have 47 graduates.
And do most students graduate in May? Do you have a mid-year?
Most students actually graduate in December. And I believe in December we had just a little over 100 graduates. I don't have the exact number in my head, but I think it was a little over 100 graduates.
So those four people are working with those 100 graduates?
25.
So when you said five students per person, that was of the bigger pool with the 20-something people?
Right, yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Yes.
So how many months do they work?
Well, it really depends. So most students, when they most students take a pre-bar prep course in their last semester. So let's say if a student is graduating in May, they would have started a pre-bar prep course in January when school started. The pre-bar prep course is to assist them in shoring up all of where their weaknesses are in various subjects. Once they finish the pre-bar prep course, they graduate, then bar prep actually starts probably 2 or 3 days after graduation. So for example, our graduation ceremony this semester will be on May 13th, and probably the Monday following that, the students will be in actual bar preparation for the July exam. So the students begin in the program and they begin the course of study. The course of study includes a plan of action, what they're to study on a daily basis, when they will be assessed and tested on it. Somewhere at the beginning of January, students will then begin to self-identify as wanting to go into the legal residency program. And the legal residency program gives them an extended period of time to take the bar. So rather than taking the bar in July, they will be in the legal residency program and then take the bar the following February.
Is there a tuition attached to the legal residency?
No, nothing. There's not even any fee associated with the bar program. Okay. So the students, there's no fee associated with it. When they enter law school, they pay their fee for barbary materials, and that's the thing that they pay, and that's it.
Okay. Now, lastly, for my line, I'll kick it over, but the crediting committee put you guys on probation, right?
No, they have not.
Well, then how come your letter says recommended that this
right.
school, why did they recommend that?
The primarily because of the low bar pass rate. So
sorry to interrupt you, but that's the kind of where I'm at here. Mm-hmm. Is it seems to me, in some instance, you're saying, well, if they don't pass the bar the first time, well, it's no big deal. It's a big deal. But it is a big deal. It could shut down your, not the first time, but even your repeats in 16. I mean, those are really low pass rates. Mm-hmm. And I guess back to my colleague, which he said, we want to make sure you have the structures in place that can bring these up. That's incumbent upon you. I get it's the student ultimately.
Right? It is the student, right? I mean, here's what I was looking at. You have a 2.2 minimum GPA requirement. Mm-hmm. And I know in my master's program, I had to maintain a 3.0. Mm-hmm. But we understand the students that are coming into your program. But if you're not holding the rigor to a higher level, they're not being prepared enough to pass this bar. Mm-hmm. Have mm-hmm. you thought about raising your GPA requirement for SAP to 3.0?
Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't thought about raising it to a 3.0. That would be traditionally very high for a law school grade point average. Okay. Most law schools are 2.0
okay.
as passing. We raised it to a 2.2 because the data that we have on just our students is that our students who graduate with a 2.2 or above perform better on the bar exam. Our students who graduate with a 2.5 or above generally will pass the bar the first time around. And so one of the things that we've put in place, for example, if a student has under a 2.5 grade point average, they go on what's called a guided curriculum. So the guided curriculum is to ensure that they take all of the courses that are tested on the bar. Because what we found when we looked at what the students were taking, so first year courses for students are already selected, so they don't get to pick. After second year, students have the option to choose from the menu of courses that are offered on the schedule. And sometimes what was happening with students is that they would pick courses that would not be the courses that are required on the bar. Some of the more difficult courses, commercial law, secure transactions, those sorts of things. Instead, they would go to the courses that were the more fun courses, the family law course or mediation or something like that, that generally are not tested on the bar. Mediation is never tested on the bar, family law on occasion. So we developed the guided curriculum for anyone under 2.5 that says, no, you must take all bar tested courses. This is what we want you to take. This is what you have to do. And I believe that we're going to see good results as a result of that.
Earlier, you wanted to say something.
Sure. I wanted to add something that had not been mentioned, which is the transfer numbers. And I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yeah, 20%.
In some years, it has been 20% to other schools. And so I think that to the extent that those folks are taking the bar on the first time and passing, that's not reflected in their numbers. And
it isn't, but it's not going to be reflected for the ABA either.
Right.
So it doesn't, again, for consumer protection, plus, because we get a lot of complaints. I've been on this board 7 years, and almost every complaint committee, one or two from Arizona Summit Law School. Now, that's probably inherent, because a lot of students that do bad think they're a lawyer at that point and want to file a complaint sometimes. Not all of them, but there are some that do. That being said, I think there's some structural cracks in processes and procedures at that school. So I'm not sure if that's why Dean May's departed and you're now in that position, but I'm certainly, we need to get them fixed, you know. We need to get this stuff done, you know, so.
We're working on it.
Yeah, I know.
And it's not just on the policies, and obviously you have a very strong background. I don't know what the former, I don't recall what the former dean's background was, although she was here often, but I just don't recall. And the reason I was asking about your experience with school is that school isn't just a business. You know, it's different how things are done. And one of the things that we have to do in your other case before us today is, you know, what is your policy? Did you follow the policy? Did you follow it fairly? So we're often looking at those. And honestly, historically, even when we found in favor of your school, there was still disappointment in how the school handled it. I don't think there's been one case that your school's come before us that I wasn't disappointed in how it was handled. Mm-hmm. And today's not going to be an exception to that. So it's nice to have sort of a fresh start with you. You both have a history with the school, and you have a very good background, so you know where these students ultimately could go. Mm-hmm. So all of that is great.
Right.
But since you don't have, you know, quite as much experience of truly managing the school, that would be my advice to you, is that how smart you are and what your background is, it gives you a foundation, but making sure that your policies are followed in organized and clear manner is really important. And it sounds like the work that you did to figure out what the sweet spot was on the GPA, that was awesome. How it was rolled out was dreadful. As you're making improvements, if you would do them thoughtfully and looking at, you know, not making changes in the middle of the term, you announce it at the start of the next term, you make sure that your staff understand what the policy change is and that there are no, you know, typos or confusion about what's going out, that the emails that go out are accurate, that type of thing. But so I feel better after listening to you today. I wasn't feeling good coming in here. Part of it is because of how many times you've been here, and I actually was going to go and look at all of my agendas to count up how many times exactly people come in, but I decided that wasn't your fault, so I wasn't going to spend the time doing it.
Well, could I just say that when I came into the office as the interim dean, one of the things that I observed as the material that was sort of left in the office for me to look over was the number of complaints to the board. And one of the first things I did is I wrote a letter to Mr. Blanchard, and I told Mr. Blanchard that my job is to ensure that our policies are followed and that they're followed consistently. When I was the academic dean, that was certainly the case. We've had several academic deans after I stepped down, and different things were happening, and policies were changing willy-nilly. I can tell you that sometimes the faculty didn't agree with the policies that were being changed in the past, and that the decision to make the changes were then made without necessarily faculty consent. I don't operate that way. One of the things that I learned by being a judicial officer for 10 years is follow the rules. And whenever I followed the rules, I was never reversed by the Court of Appeals. Most of the time when I was reversed by the Court of Appeals, it's because I didn't add up something correctly. Either somebody's sentencing numbers or something in family law where somebody was getting support or something. It was a mathematical error. But it wasn't about the rules that were not followed. And so my instruction to my managers at the school is that we follow policy. And every time that they have a thought of where they want to waiver the policy, they need to come and talk to me. And I can tell you I've had many conversations since January 1st, and I have said, follow the policies. Oftentimes, when I look at what has happened, not following the policy has been where the school has actually wanted to try to help someone, but not helping someone makes us inconsistent in if you change it for one person, you're going to have to change it for everyone, but you didn't change it for everyone, therefore there's inconsistency in application of the policy.
We run schools, so we're aware of that. Unfortunately, the part of the dean or a president, sometimes you're operating in that gray area.
Right.
The more black and white you can do, but sometimes rules, there are ways you can have
exceptions. The thing is, when exceptions are made, it has to be done meaningfully, and we'll discuss this more when your other case comes up. But being completely black and white can get you in trouble also.
Right.
Yes.
And when you're writing a policy, it's huge, as you would know being a lawyer. If you say something may occur or something will occur, and if you say will, it has to be, if it's may, then you have to have a more reasoned explanation. But the big thing is that, I'm impressed you put the effort, whoever, the group, put the effort in to figure out the appropriateness of the GPA. Again, rolled out terrible, but it sounds like before you actually got there. So I'm hopeful your approach to all this is going to mean that we won't see you like we saw in your predecessor.
I hope so, too.
and that goes a question for you, Dean Walrich, your interim, any news if you're going to get it, or are we going to see something new next month?
I know that the president is going to do a dean search as you know, what the normal process
back
is.
Up. Do you want it?
I haven't decided yet.
Okay.
Not now.
They've asked me to certainly throw my hat in the ring once the dean search begins. I don't know yet.
I'd encourage you, if you decide to go for it. I mean, I've been impressed with you today and the way you presented, and certainly you got a great background, and I hope you take Ms. Leonard's thought about school operations into
Absolutely.
And we also talk a lot on this board about puffery, and admittedly, I printed off the Potsney website that says you help with bar prep, and I highlighted it in yellow, and prior to saying all this, I was going to say, you know what? If your scores don't go up, that's going to be puffery. Mm-hmm. You need to actually help.
I met with Mr. Lively a few months ago, and he had mentioned that at the mid-year meeting for the ABA, they were going to adopt a new rule that would reduce the five-year graduating cohort in order to compile your bar pass numbers to, I think, 2 or 3 years. Did that happen?
That was Rule 316, and I don't believe it passed.
Okay.
I think it went to
the
council.
Still being held to the five-year?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Well, for you guys, it sounds like 5 years more flattering than your...
It would be for any school.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It would have affected a lot of schools if it went to 2 or 3 years.
Certainly.
But if your scores continue to improve, then a shorter period looks good for you. If your scores used to be good and now they're lousy, then the bigger period helps
you. The new rule was going to reduce it by at least half, and then also eliminate the 15%, because currently if your students fall within 15% of the state average, you're safe. But I think the ABA had discussed that if you drag down the state average, you shouldn't benefit from it.
Oh.
But yeah, I hadn't heard. They were going to fully vote on a Saturday, and then I never heard.
I don't think it passed.
So just one other thing. You know, I've managed schools where we offer master's and bachelor degrees, and I've also managed schools where we offer certificate vocational education. And of course, you know this, you have to manage and educate those groups of students entirely differently. And that's what I see for you. You've got to figure out how to educate these students successfully with the right type of rigor that they're going to be successful with the bar and not attrit so much.
Well, historically, our attrition rate was really low. And that has, and I think as we've increased rigor, that has increased as well.
Which was natural.
Natural, yes.
And Ms. Natton talked about our transfer attrition rate, and that's always been, you know, something that tugs at my heart, because oftentimes it's our best students, students with high performing GPA, students with high LSAT scores that are transferring. And oftentimes you get to know these students, you pour in resources to them, and then they go to another school. My feeling in general is that our students are adults, and if they decide that they want to transfer, that's fine. We know that many of the students that transfer were not accepted by the school that they transferred to, and they used Arizona Summit as a way to get that stepping stone to get into the school that they first applied to and didn't get admitted to. But it tugs at my heart when we lose.
But in that sense, you're still serving a purpose for those students.
Exactly.
Very much so.
Exactly. Yeah.
That was the question. Are you keeping track of if people are leaving because they feel like, well, it's great, these credits can be are being accepted, but I need to get out of here in order to get a good education, or are they being used as a stepping stone, and my goal is really to get here, and this is going to be there?
We do exit interviews with every student who lets us know that they're going to transfer, because we have to certify that they're in good standing and that sort of thing. And most of the time, the reason that students are leaving generally is because of tuition. And has nothing to do with the quality of the education. Some students will come to Arizona Summit, but they actually really want to practice in their home state. And so they do well in Arizona Summit, and then when they apply in a school in their home state, they get accepted and they want to go back. We've had several students who were actually probably over 20 students that were commuting students from Tucson. And then they did their first year, did well, and then they got into U of A, so they transferred that way. So most of the time it has nothing to do with their legal education. And we've actually had some students who have transferred and then came back because they felt that the resources and the level of what I call nurturing that we put into the students was much better at Summit than where they had transferred to. So it's generally never been, at least from my understanding, anything having to do with the quality of the education.
Call for a motion.
Well, I had a completely different idea before I came.
So did I. I'll
make one if you want. Yeah,
you're okay. Yeah. I just, just Ms. Stansfield, can we have them come back here and do regular reporting? Because I would rather, my initial thought is we'd send them to the full board, but yeah. Instead of sending them to the full board.
No, I think you're going to place them on quarterly reporting, on reporting.
Monitoring.
You can continue monitoring, especially while the ABA is considering.
Okay. So we can.
But at the board level.
Well, no, she said here, she said board.
I said board, so.
And so, if we put it up to the board, then we'll need to go to the explanation again, which not that it would be a bad thing to hear, but it is obviously a certain amount of time being spent on it.
This was a complaint that was opened by the committee, so I don't see why, since you're not taking any definitive action right now, why you can't continue monitoring. There's no action that you would request from the board to take, correct? You don't need any action from the full board?
No, I don't at this point. Not from my motion. My motion would be that I would like to
continue
monitoring and how do you do reports.
Keep an eye on how the scores are going, the stability of the staffing.
And you're doing it now?
Students, no, I didn't that really saying the thing. I discussed what we're going to do. But if we're allowed to do all of that from this level.
Okay.
September then, because June would be too soon.
Yeah.
September?
I'm good.
We'll have.
Is that far enough out?
We'll have bars.
Is that far enough out, 6 months?
Sure.
6 months?
6 months. Summer bar results come out in October.
We'll have February bar results, if not, then July.
Oh, that's, okay. So it'll be the fourth. I'll send you an agenda.
You keep it open.
Yeah, we keep it open.
We have to keep it open.
Yeah, I'm not closing it now, for sure, so, but I just didn't, I'm trying to avoid sending it to the full board at this point. It might end up there, but right now I'd like to.
I think we're still waiting on some pieces of information.
Right.
So I think it would be best if, in the meantime, we keep it at this level and not kick it up until.
Okay, so.
September 27th.
Make a motion that the Arizona Summit Law School appears before us in September to provide us with another update on the pass rate. I would also request at that time that you supply the board with, the committee with a, their official 3-year default. I don't distrust you, but I've never heard anybody having a 1% default rate, so. That's real, I gotta set eyes on it.
All right, I can send that to you, yeah.
That it, just pass rate and default rate?
Attrition.
Yeah. Attrition is an issue.
And any update to the ABA they have?
Yeah, of course, and that's real time, not wait till September.
Oh, yeah, as soon as that comes in, we'll let you know what that.
And information I threw up the DMs at the end.
Oh, yeah. That too is important.
I'll second that motion.
Thank you. Any further discussion? No, hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. No nays, no abstentions. Thank you for appearing today and the thorough explanation. We'll see you in a few minutes, I mean. Maybe not a few minutes based on this last one.
No, this will be quick.
All right, Mr. Blanchard, next item on the agenda is 17 NS505 West Coast Ultrasound appointment with Austin State Board. Please introduce.
Mr. Chair, members of the Complaint Committee, Complaint 17 NS505 was opened on December 8, 2016 when the State Board received a copy of a complaint submitted by a student at West Coast Ultrasound Institute. I listed the 9 allegations that he submitted to the accrediting agency, ACCSC. The institution submitted their response to ACCSC and gave us a copy of their response. When I gave you the information, we did not have, nor did the school have, the information regarding their findings regarding the accreditation issues. Since we've received that response, I emailed it to you, and I can't give you the date because they didn't save a copy for me, so.
It was dated March 21st, 2017.
So you have the investigative report with all the attachments and the information submitted by the institution. Answer any of your questions for West Coast Ultrasound Institute. Here is Marianne Crone, Regional Director of Operation, George Fitzpatrick, the Campus Director, and I believe Andrew Hyde, the COO, is on by phone.
Correct. Thank you.
Can you please introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, I'm Marianne Crone, Regional Director of Operations for West Coast Ultrasound Institute.
George Fitzpatrick, Campus Director, West Coast Ultrasound Institute, Phoenix.
Can I ask for the students?
There is no
student. And I'm Andrew Hyde, Chief Operating Officer for
West Coast.
What?
I don't know if the complaint was right.
I don't think the complaint is
it's
not a student.
It's a non-student complaint. Because
yeah, but I didn't know if he would still choose to join.
Oh, well. I don't believe he was noticed that it was on here.
Okay. And the reason, structurally, I don't think that needed to happen, he didn't complain to us.
I understand that, but since he had an interest in it, he may still have chosen. If he did, I would just like to know that he was on the phone.
Oh, that's what
I That's what I was asking.
Well, should we notify him?
No, I just want to know if he's on the phone.
Okay.
Who the phone yourself? Who am I talking to?
Would you like to make any opening statements?
Well, yes. Just that we did receive the complaint from ACCSC, our accrediting body. We responded on January 9th as directed. We took the complaint seriously as we really want to be supportive of our students and give them the quality education that they come to West Coast for. His complaints were, as you've already noted, 9 complaints, a laundry list of complaints. Responded to each one of these complaints with evidence-based information, and ACCSC accepted that. We responded in compliance with the standards of accreditation.
Yep, they did. Colleagues, any questions?
I just had one question about the exam, the SPI exam. Do most students, this is my curiosity, do most students end up taking that?
Most students do, because it does prepare them to take their registry exams.
And what is your, if you know, your pass rate for your students on that test?
I don't have that right in front of me. I know it's good because we have a good pass rate for the registries, but I can't give you an exact number.
Okay. You did a really good job answering all of this. So literally that was just like a personal being nosy question. It wasn't actually a question about
yourself. Sure. Members of the Client Complaint Committee, I can add to that a little bit. The FBI exam is something that is not required to practice as an ultrasound technician in the state of Arizona or California where we operate. So it's something that we encourage students to take, but they're not required to take. So sort of it's a very different structural relationship than the bar exam the previous with Arizona Summit, where that is required to perform the job that they're coming to us to be educated for.
Okay. Thank you. It's really unusual to not have more questions, so I had to come up with at least one.
Pretty soon. I really don't have anything, so I'll make a motion to dismiss the complaint.
I'll second.
All right, any further discussion? Not hearing any, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And the ayes have it. Any ayes, no abstentions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I saved you having to
Before we got this, it
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Where's the list?
Dave Powell will step
in. I'm going to take it.
Can I recess?
Yeah. Recess. We'll go into a quick 5-minute recess. There's a complaint committee meeting back into session at 2:10.
Oh,
okay, Mr. Tharp has called the meeting back to order. Thank you.
Okay, moving on now to the student complaints agenda item number 4. First one up is number 17-S004. Schools, Arizona Summit Law School, and complainant is A.M. Mr. Blanchard, if you can introduce, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the Complaint Committee, on August 29, 2016, board staff received a complaint from student A.M. regarding his termination from Arizona Summit Law School due to his not meeting satisfactory academic progress policy as set forth in student handbook number 2.4.6.3. He stated he received an email from Ms. Anderson and a professor at the school and assured him he was in good academic standing for the fall 2015 semester. He believes there's a violation of policies regarding his dismissal pertaining to the change of the GPA requirement from a 2.0 to 2.2. I did speak to Dean Mays. There was something in reference to a second chance program. He was not eligible for that based on his GPA being below 2.0. Institutions submitted all the documentation in reference to their response, including the explanation of the rule change and the policy when it was communicated to students. I believe AM is on the phone to answer any of your questions, and for the institution is Nicole Stanton, the attorney, and Dean Penny Wilrich.
Names for the record again, please.
Sure. Nicole Stanton on behalf of Arizona Summit Law School.
Penny Wilrich, interim dean of Arizona Summit.
And to confirm, AM, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Would you like to make any opening statement?
No, I'm okay. Thank you.
Okay. You'll be available for questions. Would the school like to make any?
No, we'll just based on the papers that we submitted. No amending.
Okay. I'll start to my right then. Questions?
Okay. My background is in financial aid, and particularly satisfactory progress is an area of expertise for me. So that's why I was interested in your explanations previously of how you came up with the GPA, et cetera. And based on the student's academic record, honestly, I understand why he was dismissed from the school. What confuses me, and I have to assume it would confuse him or anyone else that was in the same situation as him, is the messages from the school were so unclear that I literally took a pad of paper and attempted to mark out what exactly happened. And looking through the emails and messages were given to him, the old policy, the new policy, and even though when all is said and done, considering his GPA was continuing to go down, I understand why he was dismissed. However, I also understand why he perhaps feels that he shouldn't have been, and that's really unfair. He has now spent undeniably a lot of time and expense having to sort of push back to have an understanding of why. And a lot of that confusion was caused by the way your school rolled out the policy, the emails that were sent to him, the flipping back and forth of whether you are okay, you're not okay, you are okay, you're not okay. If you weren't okay, if you're not okay, you can't register for classes, but you let him register for classes. So that makes him think that he is okay. And the whole thing was so unbelievably confusing. I'm actually surprised we don't have more students complaining for that period of time. So I guess that's my big statement, is that I think that you did this student a big injustice. I honestly think, based on reading his stuff, that even if you had done a good job of it, I think he would have still wanted to deny the applicability to him. However, it would have been easier to follow the string if a better job had been done. So I won't bother going through each of these items that show the confusion that I used to sort of track the whole thing, but I think, honestly, that's what it comes down to, is a administrative capability thing rather than a policy thing. He clearly had been, he was in a downward trajectory, right? So he started out healthy 2.28 GPA, then he had 2.12, which was still good, but lower than your now current standards. And then he went down to 1.87. We don't have his grades here from the spring, so I think I read in here it brought it up, but still less than a 2.0, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was a 197.
197.
Right. Yeah. 197.
So I guess really for me then, the issues are, one, you handled it poorly, don't do that again. If you can roll out a policy, it needs to be rolled out clearly to students and staff. It has to have a clear start date. The notifications to students has to be clear. And your explanation of how the transition is done is critical. Like the little thing that went out saying, hey, guess what, good news, we're rating your GPA because we know it's better for you. But not telling them how they're going to get there, that was very, very poorly done. Your policy has the dead and done, that if you get a certain GPA, you're out of here without any probation or anything else. He kind of had two things going. You're on probation for the spring. Oh, no, I mean you're on probation for the fall. Oh, no, I mean you're on probation for the spring. Oh, you know what? Never mind that. You're being kicked out anyway because your GPA is too low for any of that. That's just wicked confusing. But they need to be rolled out better clearly. And if that is a drop dead of a certain GPA or less, he got there awfully fast, right? From 2.12 to you're gone in one term. So that feels pretty harsh to me, but at the same time, your school is very expensive, so letting him go an extra term when he clearly is in a down trajectory isn't good either. So I'm going to trust that your, whatever you call that deal where they can petition, even though they're not on probation, they can say, oh, I really shouldn't be kicked out. However that is, would be good for you to make sure that it's fair. But also the courses that he took in the spring intercession, since you're not charging him, and his grades are not on his transcript here. I'm wondering if since you shouldn't have apparently let him enroll them in them, but he did take them. Is that fair to not let him have the grades on that, on his transfer, since he took it and he passed them? Would it be fair to let him have those grades, even though it is appropriate for you not to charge him?
So you're saying don't count the grades for purposes of the applicability of our policy, but allow them on his transcript for future use at another institution?
Because the way your policy is end of the fall, that was adopted. So the end of the fall, he didn't meet your requirements to stay in school. I get that. That's your written policy?
Yes.
And I also, I can't remember now whether that particular cutoff he had would have gotten him kicked out under the old policy or just the new. I can't recall. I didn't bring my, it was so sloppy by the time
I was
done.
You're talking about the 2.12?
No.
No.
When the deal that if you have a certain GPA, you're out without any anything else, that one?
Right.
And his 1.87 gave him that trigger?
It was 1.90 was the new floor.
1.90 is the new one. So what was the old one?
The old one was, it was 1.41. That's correct. 1.41.
Okay. So that's another problem of the rollout. That is a huge difference. And 1.41 honestly was woefully low, right? So I commend you for raising it. But typically, you give a person a warning term. So they were doing well, they're not doing well, and then you say, hey, you're not doing well, you're being put on probation, warning, whatever the word's going to be for the next term, and at the end of that, you're gone, and then you can appeal, but it's probably not going to work for you. In your case, after the term started, he started the term at 1.12, so he was good. In the middle of the term somewhere, you start saying, hey, 1.12 is not good anymore. 2.12, sorry, is not good anymore. So now you're on probation for this term. And then, oh, by the way, the drop-dead kick you out of school is going from 1.41 to 1.9. So he went from, I'm okay, I'm on probation, I'm out of here, all in a very, very short time with, in my opinion, insufficient warning. You are allowed to change your policies. And his lawyers and his argument that those interim grades should have helped him, it's after the point, because the policy is when you hit that point, you're out and you're allowed to have that policy. But the rollout was just so poor.
The only point of clarification I would have there is that the rollout of the 1.94, as I understand it, happened in August of 2015 when the semester started.
Okay.
So going into fall semester, he would have been aware, had he read the manual, he would have been aware that that floor was 1.9.
Okay, that is good. I did pick up on that. How was that information given to the students?
How was it disseminated?
It was, and I think that he references it in his complaint, it was part of the policy and procedure handbook that students are given. And there's an email, it's on our exhibit.
And most manuals are like, you know, hundreds of pages, so.
I understand, and point well taken. There is a message from the dean talking about the handbook. I think your point is, if there are changes like that are made, those are probably worth highlighting, a change like a drop-dead floor.
Yeah, like the Department of Ed, when they make changes in the handbook, they have at the beginning of the chapter, they say, here are the significant changes. So like at the SAP, when it went from that all schools had to uniformly use the word warning, because schools were using different words, so a few years ago, the Department of Ed came out and said, you know what, here's the deal. If you don't call it warning, you can't have these fringes allowed with it. So schools had to change their wording to say it was warning. Well, they clearly gave that message. Even if you didn't read, and the manual's this big, if you didn't read the manual that big, you could go to the beginning of the chapter, you see right away, that's a big change, I need to change my policy, because we say probation, it has to be warning. It's very easy to tell. So I think that your rollout was hard to follow, and so they really were the two things. There was one, going from 1.41 to the 1.9, that was a big deal. So if it was disseminated prior to the start of the term, that gives me some comfort. You know, I still think, like, in being fair, you are fair, but are you accurate in kicking him out for it? Absolutely. Based on how his transcript is and taking those in-session classes, do I think he, if you gave him an extra term, would he have anything more than just more debt? I don't think so. But I do think that it was rolled out poorly, and I do think that because he took the classes and got passing grades, I can't make you, but it would behoove you to give him credit for those classes.
Okay, thank you.
So another of his options is to sit out a year and then start all over again.
Correct.
That's what I was going to say. The last with this love letter that I was reading had said. It's real rough. This is what I was talking about when I was saying that we, when we're school operators, we operate, try to keep a black line, but we really operate with the rain. And I guess, I don't know. I'm on the fence. Again, I don't think statutorily you're going to get anything against the statute. But I think this was a change of policy that hit this guy, and it was no attempt in school to try to say, okay, let's see what we can work out or do. It was just like, line in the sand, done. And I get that, but it bothers me because I think your communication was very poor to the students. Your internal emails back and forth to him were contradictory at times and not even making any sense. So as a student and somebody who's here to protect the students, I really feel for that, you know. I just think it's a bad deal. I would have liked to see, in this case, because this was at the chance of the school, try to work with him or accept those grades. Yeah, I can't make you statutorily. I'm just giving you my editorial on the piece. It was very disappointing to me. And it seems to be the trend we've seen for Arizona Summit Law School in the past, and that's all I'll say.
And from the student perspective on the phone, even though they did do a poor job, and also the arguments on your end were confusing about whether those classes should count, your lawyer really went a lot in discussing those classes, which were irrelevant for this case. But it seems like if they had done a better job of rolling it out, you'd still be dismissed because of your grades. So that's kind of where I am, is that I feel like you as a student, your record, academic performance, didn't justify you staying in. If they had not changed their policy, you would have had another term and on probation, and you would have taken out more loans. And on the path that you're currently taking, I think that then you would have kicked out the end of the spring term. So then you would just be in more debt and have spent more of your time. So I don't feel like I even want to ask this school to say, oh, gee, they should have not kicked you out, whether they could have done anything with you to help you get your grades up is a whole other question. But from the school perspective, I guess I feel like, Jim, that they are, even though the case itself doesn't have merit based on what he's arguing about, it brought to light poor administration.
Well, the question we've had on this committee for sure is administrative capacity at this school, and I don't think this case, again, although statutorily not anything that, you know, I could say you have to do this, or not that we could anyway, but it's troubling, and it continues to be troubling. I do feel for the student. I understand what you're saying about the 1.9, and after he got done with the summer classes, it would have been up to a 1.7 or whatever, or something in that exact thing. Could he? Would he have done it? I don't know. He didn't, and he was dismissed, and that's where we lie today.
Yeah.
So now it gets into a question from our own lovely legal counsel. What would be an appropriate admonishment to the school to say, yes, the student, based on policies, should in fact have been dismissed based on his academic performance, but such a poor job was done in rolling out the policy and in the dealings with the student and the confusion of, oh, forget those last two emails, but it's really this one. And
yeah.
That was really, that was a mess.
I think the issue here is that there is no violation of state statute or rule, so I don't think it would warrant any kind of formal action. Your only non-disciplinary action is a letter of concern, but that's usually an admonishment of, if you continue in your practices going forward, you're bound to violate a state statute. But I guess I would need information on what statute they might violate. Essentially, they stuck to their policy.
That's the problem.
It's a new policy. It wasn't communicated.
It's a new policy that they rolled out after the term started. They told the student, you're okay, you're not okay, you're okay, ignore those last two, you're not okay again. You're on probation for the spring, no, you're on probation for the fall. Oh, another new policy that came out that says you're just out of here. I mean, literally, I'm an expert in satisfactory progress, and I had a hard time following it. And that doesn't normally happen.
No, I can't understand myself.
Well, based on that scenario, are you willing to negotiate with the student to try to come up with a solution that's amenable to both parties? Or is it, this is it, he's out?
I mean, to be fair, we would probably have to take a few minutes to talk about that. That's not been something we discussed. He does not, he would not be allowed to continue under the policy, and so we would have to make an exception, and then we'd probably be back here at some point being criticized that we let someone generate a large amount of debt who was ultimately not successful and didn't pass the bar.
That's a challenge,
we're sort of in a catch, it's a double-edged sword, and so in this case, it's sort of a catch-22 for us. But that, to your specific question, we have not discussed any sort of position that is different than dismissal.
So for your letter of concern options, typically when we see cases like this, which you see many cases like this, it's for failure to follow the published administrative policies. Here they followed the policy, but however, probably didn't provide notice to the students in the most...
They followed their policy, but they rolled it out poorly. They sent incorrect emails to the students.
It didn't appear that the staff even knew.
The only statute that I think might apply is that failure to have adequate management capability as determined by the board. If you'd like to issue a letter of concern saying this does not rise to the level of discipline, however, continue.
You mentioned the two intersection classes. That was number two of his resolution on his complaint.
Yeah, I think it's fair to give him the grades.
Is that even a possibility?
And I know you wrote down, but I don't know if you're in a position to authorize that. Do you have to go back and ask somebody if you can get those grades?
Let me speak to the dean just momentarily.
Well, again, there's also taking it up to the board because we can do a lot more things from the board level than we can
I guess the question
that's
is
violation,
if you,
what are you going to take right.
I guess the question is if you referred it to the board, what else would you like them to do?
I don't think so.
You could enter into an agreement to make sure they notify their students more clearly, but would that happen?
All I know is,
With regard to including the intersession grades, a couple of problems with that. One is other similarly situated students. We would be making an exception for him, and there may be other students out there that would fall into the same boat. That's problem number one. Problem number two is with regard to our representation on our transcript to another school, another legal institution, they would have no way of knowing that he truly did not get credit for those at our institution. We could not, to my knowledge, there's no special notation system that we could put on there. It would be, we're giving him the grades, and he did not earn those grades under Summit's policies and procedures. So it's sort of a misrepresentation.
Okay, so tell me what that brings me to then. So,
yeah.
You rolled the policy out late, jacked him around, sending him, you are good, you're not good, you are good, you're probation here, you're probation there, never mind. And then if you weren't okay, we wouldn't let you register for classes. Not only did we let you register for them, we let you register for them, let you pay for them, we let you take them. Now, after the fact, you've spent your time, your money, we'll give you back your money, but you can't give him back his time. And so that goes to administrative capability to me. So now I feel very strongly that we do have to, this whole thing was handled so poorly, and I do think the student deserved to be dismissed. I honestly do. But we jacked him around, you know? That's not fair. Not you personally. Not even me personally.
Understood.
Yeah, I think I'm very happy with the letter of concern at this point.
Do we need to go to a session to get more? Are you okay with this?
The letter of concern, I think, is pretty self-explanatory. Your only other options would be to either dismiss or send this up to a full board for an informal interview.
Well, we're dismissing the case, though, but we're... But
you wouldn't be dismissing the case. The letter of concern would be the resolution for the case.
Resolution.
Oh, okay. All right. So it would essentially be closing the case, but they would have a letter of concern, non-disciplinary on the bill.
Or it can go up for the informal, and you could do it.
I kind of want to put them all through, going through all what the hours we spent trying to figure this out to have them in. I can't imagine there's something different than a lawyer was coming.
Let's let them have some.
It sure was for me. I had a whole schematic out there.
I know, I did too.
It likes that stuff.
Forgive my handwriting, I chose not to speak.
I'll lose track
of it. Oh, so a letter of concern for administrative management
The board is concerned that, that the school may be in danger of failing.
Okay.
32305.
Let me get the exact language. Yeah, I had a client who used to say, if there's one, how many more could there be? I'm hearing him in my head right now. And I understand that he is on his board, the situation now, but I'm wondering if there are other students who have as big of a mess as here, and whether they end up being kicked out or they're still there. I just find it hard to believe that this is the one instance.
Well, we've seen it before.
No, I know.
This is from the same school.
That's it. So, it would be a letter of concern stating that the board is concerned that
the committee or the board?
That the committee is concerned that the that Summit
fails to have adequate management capability.
Right. Adequate management capability.
32305-1.
Sorry, can you restate that?
32-305-110.
I think she said that. 32-305-110?
32-305-1. 32-305-1.
Good. All right. I make the motion to request a letter of concern.
File
a letter of concern regarding Arizona Summit Law School's failure to have adequate management controls pursuant to
32305.10.
32305.10. Of course, she's
that.
I know right where it's at.
I second. Having a motion and a second, do we have any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. The ayes have it. No nays, no abstentions. Thank you.
We'll see you
hopefully
September.
We don't see you.
Until September.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, Kel. Well, that's
we're
a
probably
different
not
one.
Making her think, gee, I want to be the dean either.
She's just the lady to clean it up.
Have a good afternoon. We'll try.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm just wondering now what is the resolution here for me?
Basically, the matter is between the board and the licensee. That there is not basically any resolution for you per se. The action is between the board and the school.
Okay.
Okay.
So basically what they were saying that I should have the grades and whatnot, what will happen with that?
No, they determined that it was inappropriate, and because those grades were not earned at Arizona Summit, therefore they could not put those grades on the transcript.
Okay.
Well, they were earned, but they Yeah, it was the opinion of the board. This is the chairman, and it was the opinion of the board that we were trying to see if they would be willing. We don't have statutory rules or authority to make them do this, any of those things. See, we have to operate by what our statutes allow us to. We had Ms. Leonard strongly suggested that they give you those grades because you did earn them in the school declined.
Okay.
Okay.
So in other words, if I were to try to get that or some other resolution, I would have to go using some other legal means.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I would think, unless you try to work with the school one more time, but if they're not going to do it, then you would have to take some other recourse, okay?
Okay, understood.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, AM, for your patience today.
Thank you.
All right, moving along in our agenda, the next on the agenda is item, agenda item four, number B, 17-S005, Grand Canyon University, and the complainant is MD. Mr. Blanchard, please introduce.
Mr. Chair, members of the Complaint Committee, complaint 17-S005 was received on December 1st, 2016. MD stated he was terminated from Grand Canyon University for several code of conduct violations. I've listed in the complaint summary what he indicated were words used that were posted in the forum that caused the issue. The institution responded to staff's request. There's a large, long history in reference to what transpired between the university and what was actually posted and said from complainant MD. He has completed the grievance procedure and he has exhausted all available appeals. His allegations was wrongfully terminated and did not agree with the outcome of his student code of conduct decision. I've given you the institutional response. I gave you copies of the fall 2015 handbook policy specific to student code of conduct decisions and also the spring of 2017. Here to answer any of your questions from the university is Gina Bilkey, Legal Specialist, Office of General Counsel. And I don't know if MD is on the phone or not.
MD, are you on the phone?
I haven't heard from him in quite some time.
Okay, thank you. Any statements or just available for questions?
I'm available for questions. I'll defer to our response on the merits here.
I would agree with that. There's some questions in here that I have. So we move through these complaints that I have a little bit of issues with the university. But
it's concerning that you as general counsel came, but the administrators of the policy, unless that's part of your role, also. Yeah. So are you able to answer, for this case? This in your reply, or whoever did this reply, they said there was exceptions to the code of conduct, but normally we would have gotten the policy and been told exactly where in the policy it is. That
sure.
wasn't given.
Sure.
So Mr. Blanchard supplied it to us, but it's a multi-page policy, and we're going through looking to see exactly what. I'm sort of assuming it's the civility and respect, but I don't know because
sure.
you didn't answer it. Not you, but your school
sure.
didn't answer it. The people who do this are not here to answer. And those are the questions I personally want to ask on this one, is that there's a lot of leeway, obviously, when it comes to potentially violent situations. We would never ask the school to go against their gut feeling that a student is a potential we could bring harm to himself or the school. So the difficulty here, and the student isn't here online, so we'll probably discuss this more freely, but just not hurting his feelings. But it looks to me like there really were, I first had notes saying that there were three instances, and the policy says three, but then when I actually look at it, the third one was really referencing back to the second one. So now I would like to ask the questions of, if your policy has first, second, and third, and it kind of looks like it's first, second, and then multiple iterations of revolving on the second one, what brought it up to the instance of saying it's time to kick them out rather than it being a third instance? Was it because of the level of it? I don't know.
I think the guy's the student's communication in my mind was clearly inappropriate, and not always inappropriate. I think it's absolutely all right to question your teachers and demand to get your money's worth. That's not the society we live in. You can't. I just think the way which he went about that crossed the line.
Right, he bullied back saying, you need to let me stay in or I'm going to kill myself.
Right.
You
know.
Well, that kind of stuff. But I guess to a larger area, again, about administrative and management capacity, I am disappointed, and this is not that you're here, we're glad that you came, but that we don't have representation from the academics department that apparently sends all these letters. And the other part of the thing that I have a problem with is I have a problem when things are so complex at a university or a school that it becomes so confusing to the student to how to go to who to where and what. And like your letters aren't even signed, you know, denying them and telling them these things are the Office of Academic Compliance, Grand Canyon University. I can name four letters in here like that. Who is that? You know, he explained frustration when he specifically called Dr. Rada, you know, trying to get a response, who we know this board knows very well and respects very well, but was it somebody else completely different responded and said, hey, we're going to do this. So if the university thinks it's going to, you know, that's going to help any situations or it's going to keep you away from this board and this committee, they're sorely mistaken. And you guys are getting bigger and bigger, and it's just, it's got to be a little bit better than this in my estimation. And this is just, again, the merit, sort of like she said with the last one, I don't question your merits for dismissal so much in this case. I the communication and who he's able to talk to and stuff, I do question that should have been much better and much clearer, and you should have the recourse to do that. And again, I'll just show.
Sure. Well, to clarify, you know, he was issued three separate code of conduct violations. The third was actually, you know, in addition to the second one.
Can you explain that to me? That exactly. So it was one was on
September 22nd, 2014, and that actually resulted in a warning, not you know university level sanction, where we did tell him that any you know further similar hostile behavior could result in multiple sanctions, including expulsion. So he was put on notice then. The second one was on September 7th, 2015. And then the third one was on September 16th, 2015, so a few days later. So what happened was the instructor who initially submitted the second code of conduct violation on September 7th was the same exact instructor to issue the one on September 16th because the student just continued to communicate in a very hostile and antagonistic way. In terms of our review process, we do have a two-step appeal process, which the student went through both appeals. So he went through the first appeal on November 15, 2015, which was reviewed by the SVP of our academic affairs. And then the decision was issued on November
18, 2015. Yeah, timeline to investigative report. It's easier to read than that. My report, yeah, it starts on the bottom of page 2, every date, and what was all the way through January 26, 2016.
Yeah, when I reviewed this, I didn't have the policy, right? So when I reviewed it all, and it made sense that he was expelled, but our rules compared to the policy. So then when I was trying to compare it to the policy, and it clearly said steps 1, 2, 3, and so when I first went through this, and I thought I had 1, 2, 3, and then I started thinking, oh, no, that's still on the September 7th.
It's
so
hard,
I was thinking,
it's
I
hard to read
third.
On that.
Yeah, but so if there really are three, then that means that they did follow their policy. But again, as you said, not necessarily well done in the in the response or in response to the student.
Sure.
And obviously, the student saying things like it's because he's an atheist. You know, I understand that doesn't have merit. From what you tell me, obviously.
And so just to continue on it, and so he went through the first level of appeal on his expulsion on November 15th, and that was denied on November 18th, just 3 days later, and then he appealed that decision on December 28th, and that was reviewed by our provost, and ultimately the first level appeal decision was upheld, so his expulsion was upheld at that time. The expulsion is for 2 years, so I believe his he will be eligible to apply for reinstatement on October 1st, 2017. You know, I would like to note that, you know, reinstatement's not guaranteed, but it will be reviewed by the dean, and he does choose to reapply, and he would make a decision at that point.
Given the nature of his responses and what he stated his personal situation was for the, you know, safety of him and students, would there be part of that review process being whether there's adequate things in place to ensure that this isn't going to escalate again, perhaps in a physical?
Well, he's not. He's an online student in Georgia, so he's never interfaced with his students.
He was actually a campus student, wasn't he?
No.
No.
He was not.
No, he was online. He lives in Macon, Georgia, yeah. And that's where he attended. So, but still, I think she brings up a point. Still, we'll ask him for that as far as him reaching out and actually punching a student in the class.
Sure.
Well, and I'm not in any way saying somebody who has issues he had shouldn't get an education. Obviously, that's not the case. It just ends up being a safety issue. When I read all this without having a policy, but was just reading all this, I could. It's easy to see when someone is the one that's being targeted by it. It's an emotional response to them, and that's why I assume now that I have this that it's the bullying statute or bullying policy that took over.
Yeah, reading it too, it's clear to me that, you know, he's certainly crossing the bullying. What was less clear to me, and granted that Grand Canyon is not a social service agency, was this guy, I think, was two classes out from graduating, or very close to graduating. And for all, at least anything the school provided or us, you know, I'm wondering, he did all right, you know, what didn't have any other problems. And clearly, self-admittedly, here's a guy in a pretty, in a mental health crisis that's happening, you know, that's right there. So, you know, it's evident reading that it's an escalating.
Yeah, and actually, based on the things we read on the website about the admission of the school of touch, but it's not your requirement to do those. But I mean, his threat saying, no, each person is in this committee one way or the other. If I were on the committee, I would feel threatened by that.
Me too.
But obviously, I do feel badly that somebody who has PTSD is in this situation, but
sure.
Not that it would be the school's job. But I feel bad he got this far. I can't go any farther, but I also can see why people would be concerned.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's it. You provided some assistance, behavioral health assistance.
Correct.
At a location near in Georgia.
Yes, we did a wellness check. We called the local sheriff's office and had them check on the student.
Right.
So we do have protocols in place when students do make threats to themselves and others.
Obviously. So they did do a wellness check and they did give him.
They did a wellness check after he said, suicide. For sure.
That's when you do it.
Right.
I mean, and then again, also try to give them some resources.
Again, I can't fault the school. I don't see any fault at the school. I don't know how much we have to deliver without him on the phone.
Hold it as an annoyance that the appropriate people didn't come to this meeting either.
Sure. But,
we'll say it on the next two complaints.
I will definitely bring that feedback.
Yeah, we, it tends to get us in a bad mood when we're 10 miles up the road and you show up.
Understood.
You know, when you have, especially when you have not one, but three complaints on our agenda today.
And honestly, if Mr. Blanchard hadn't taken any time to get us that, we probably would have had to postpone this, which we've done with other cases, saying this insufficient information here.
And you still are able to postpone if there are pressing questions that you would like to add their administration to.
We rarely answer only because he got us the information, which I tried going on your website to find it, and it's a rabbit hole to get there, but we did find it. I shouldn't have had to spend the time this morning looking for it and then calling him and asking if he had it anywhere, and he was able to find it and get it to me.
Sure.
Then it had to be distributed to us, so we're reading prior to
this
meeting.
Sure,
yeah.
Understood. And that was what policy, Keith?
He was dismissed because of the GCU's code of conduct, and in all of this thing, they went, you know, all the way up to V, one of these tabs was not the policy, or clearly stating what part of the policy was being referenced of why it was. So
sure.
We had to figure it out on our own
where
the policy was. And if you look on the website, there's an update every day in term. So we were trying to figure out which policy it was. So we shouldn't have to do that.
Sure, understood.
Okay, if there are no further questions, I'll make a motion that we dismiss the complaint. That's point number 17-S005 against Grand Canyon University. Motion and second. Any further discussion?
So we did ask for some forgiveness, not to be expelled, to learn from his mistakes, chance to apologize.
We granted an extension on the hearing that he requested.
Right.
You know, we initially gave him a warning for the first time and gave him notice that he could potentially be expelled if
right.
the behavior continued. He actually didn't show up at the hearing. You know, when we gave him the opportunity to be heard, we gave him the extension.
We said show up. I think that's what made me think that he was physically there. It
sure.
would have been he could have called in.
Correct.
Right. He said he didn't have a phone at the one time. Okay.
Thank you. Okay, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. The ayes have it unanimously. No nays, no abstentions. Thank you. Don't go anywhere. All right, moving on to the agenda item number 4C. Complaint 17-S006, Grand Canyon University, and the complaint is RJ. Mr. Blanchard, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the Complaint Committee, Complaint 17-S006 was submitted on August 1st, 2016 by RJ, who was a prior student at GCU. I'll ask you, you know, his last date of attendance was May 29th, 2013. The issue on last communication with Grand Canyon University and the student was June 23rd, 2013 before we received the complaint. Did you want to present the whole thing or did you want to determine?
No, I think I'd like to determine, and I don't know if we need an executive session for that. I think I'd like to discuss with an executive. Okay. So I'll make a motion that we go into executive session. Second. Okay. So we'll go in. And I must publicly read this before we go into executive.
We're going to have you step out.
I'm doing the minutes.
Are we just doing executive session for legal advice?
Yes.
Okay, so we're going to have you step out
sure.
your bag.
That's you reading.
And then you read it once we're in.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
The phone needs to go.
If anyone is on the line, I will hang up. When executive session is concluded, I will call back in. If you want to, you could go ahead and call back in and you'll hear music till I call in. Thank you.
That's the reality of financial aid. You can't carry any spectrum if you're on HG1.
Welcome to CenturyLink conferencing. Please enter your passcode followed by the pound or hash key, and I'll connect. Please hold while I confirm your passcode. Thank you. Your passcode is confirmed. When you hear the tone, you will be the second person to join the meeting.
Hi, this is Terry. We will be going back into regular session. Someone's on the line. Could you identify yourself, please?
Who?
Hello?
I'm sorry? Okay. I'm sorry. Yes, we're not to your particular item yet. Thank you.
Okay, Arizona State Board for Private Post-Secondary Education Complete Committee meeting is back in regular session. Again, can you state your name again for the record? This is a separate complaint.
Sure. Gina Billick, legal specialist at Grand Canyon University.
Okay. Complaint RJ, are you on the phone?
Okay.
Isn't it? So, would you like me?
Yeah, I'll just tell what we're trying to figure out is our statutory authority. Whether it's outside the frame of that, and whether it's not.
Sure. What I need to know is, from reading this file, it wasn't clear. Did RJ ever file a complaint with GCU saying that he wanted this issue examined?
He did not.
Okay. And so,
you didn't consider the request from Mr. Blanchard to be an appeal of anything?
We did not.
This was just, okay. So in that case, it would be a two-year statute of limitations from last date of attendance.
With hearing that, then if we don't have any other discussion, I'll make a motion to dismiss the complaint because it's outside of our two-year window to file a student complaint.
Second.
Motion and second. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The ayes have it. No nays, no abstention. Thank you.
Does GCU have a statute of limitations on when a student can file a complaint?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, so they can, 10 years down the road, say, I feel like I was wrong. They can file a complaint.
Like a third-party agency?
No, when you know.
Oh,
with us,
internally.
Yes.
You know, I'm not certain.
We should do this.
I absolutely understand the rule.
I understand the rule as I explained it as well, but there's a case law that defines
Okay, moving on. Agenda item 4D, 17-S007. School's Grand Canyon complaint is TC. Mr. Blanchard.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the complaint committee, complaint 17-007 was received by the State Board on March 9th, 2017, in reference to TC, who is a current student at GCU. In her submission, TC said she attempted to take the final exam in a PSY 357 class, which opened on Monday, December 12th, 2016. She attempted to take the exam on December 13th, but her computer froze. When she rebooted her computer, she was then lost the exam. When she attempted to take the exam, it indicated on her computer that it was already in progress. In the submission, there is a history of the sequence of events which took place from December 13, 2016 through Thursday, December 22, 2016. And this included communication with IT, communication with Tim Jones, student service manager at the institution, as well as her instructor. Here to answer any of your questions is, I believe it's Marie, which is TC's mother. There is assigned FERPA, I think, with the institution to allow her to speak for her daughter, and for the institution is Gina Bilek, the legal specialist, Office of the General Counsel.
Okay, one more time with the name for record.
Gina Bilek, legal specialist, Grand Canyon University.
Okay, and the mom, what's your name? Can you introduce?
Marie Coleman.
Thank you, Marie. And TC, where is the complaint?
She was on the phone, but her phone just died. I can't get her back.
Okay.
Some more technical issues.
Dang. All right, Marie.
Yeah, I mean, she's been on the phone since 1 p.m.
Yeah. So, Marie, would you like to make any statement? Although she's not the complainant, I don't know how this works.
She knows the history, I guess, if you want to allow her to.
Yes, I do know the history. I'm not really, you know, obviously I've not done this before. I don't know if you guys have read the sequence of events. I'm not quite sure what you want to hear. I guess
you don't have
that,
to.
I'm sorry?
It's up to you. We have all the stuff you submitted and the school's response, and we have all read that.
I guess I just want to say that, you know, it just makes no sense for my daughter to not attempt to take the test, which is what GCU ultimately, I believe, is implying that she, in the big scheme of things, she did not attempt to take it when they reopened it, and that's just not accurate.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have any questions?
Well, I'm just frustrated because you're the only one here, because here's the thing. Reading the history of all of this, honestly, I am shocked that her first appeal was not approved. And yes, the process was filed, but I think incredibly unfairly. She was on it and trying and trying and trying, and no one at that time appears told her that she had to get the screenshots to show the evidence. Now after the fact, oh, because you didn't take the appropriate screenshots to prove that you were doing it, even though looking at history, how many people did she talk to? She'd be told you're ready to do it, she'd go in, she couldn't do it. It seems unbelievably unfair. She's clearly a really good student, and I don't understand why they're inclined to deny us once again, but I want to be able to say we've given every opportunity. Well, you know what? I think she was given every opportunity, but none of them were able to follow through. So it doesn't do any good to say you can have something that's 10 miles away, but you can't get there. And that's essentially what happened to this student.
Sure.
So I think it was terribly unfair the appeals were not.
Sure. To your point, even without the screenshots provided by the student, GCU's records would have indicated if the student would have reattempted test.
If her computer is frozen, she couldn't get in, and the instructor said, I don't see that you even started it, but her side showed she did, so she was frozen. So, you know what, in my mind, how do you prove that it wasn't on your server? Where's your proof that it wasn't your server that caused this problem?
Sure.
I'd like to see a screenshot that absolutely proves that you can guarantee that she did not go in. I mean, I don't think you're proving your case based on this.
Sure. Aside from that, we did reset the test for her to retake it twice on December 19th and December 20th. We allowed her, two more days to take the test. And again, our systems do not show that she even attempted to log in and take the test.
She was having issues.
She was having issues, and the IT guy,
student services, who basically supported her position from your institution.
And IT was saying, no, I'm telling you, try another browser, right? You're out of luck. So when IT can't help you, I mean, as a user who's gotten, I'm pretty savvy with the computer, but I got to tell you, I've hit that point where I can't get any farther. And when the person on the end says, oh yeah, I'm not able to solve your problem, but is there anything else I can do to help you today? And I always say, no, because you haven't helped me yet. And that's what I feel like happened to her, that she called for help, they couldn't help her, and then here's this good student who's just being penalized. Right. I just don't understand it.
Well, that's when IT referred her back to faculty, and then faculty did reset the exam twice, first on December 19th, again on December 20th, notified the student that the exam had been reset. So at that time, she could have gone in and restarted the test.
But she tried.
She tried. She couldn't get in.
She couldn't get in, so she assumed the instructor did not reset the test. I mean, I get it, in your policy. IT problems are not an excuse for taking a test, but she had this problem on the 13th, and the instructor didn't even respond until the first time until the 17th.
Yes, that's not. The student's being penalized because the instructor ate up 4 days for time to take the test. The instructor ate up by not replying to her.
Sure.
And according to this, on the 18th, she sent a message to the instructor, said what IT said. The 19th, the instructor opened it. She still couldn't get in. On the 20th, the instructor said, okay, you can take it again. She still couldn't get in. Then on the 21st, she contacted IT again. I think it clearly
shows.
Now,
that's her time frame, granted. That's what she's saying.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think there's some proof to that.
Our records show that she actually reached out to the instructor on the 13th. The instructor responded on the 16th. I can't speak to the delay there. And the instructor informed the student on the 16th to contact IT, and the student actually didn't contact IT until December 18th, which was 2 days later, which was the last day of the class and the day that the exam was actually due.
According to the student, she contacted the instructor on the instructor didn't respond until the 17th, which was a Saturday, and she did on the 18th. So again, we have a little difference of, and by then, honestly, I feel like the instructor already ate up a good chunk of her opportunity to do it. So since the instructor took 3 or 4 days, depending on whose time frame you use, I don't see why the student is penalized for the instructor's delay in getting back to her. And the fact that IT was not able to help her, I think was a problem.
Sure. If you look at our records, the faculty member actually did respond on the 16th at 1:44 p.m., if you look at under tab 2. And again, we allowed the student until the 20th
to take the exam. So even if you argue that the faculty member did delay in responding to the student, we afforded her that extra time to take the exam until the 20th.
But so, hang on a second. So on December 16th at 1:44,
right.
And then at 1:45, at my end, it's stating that you haven't attempted the exam. Since it says this, I can't reassign it to you. You may need to reach out to our tech support.
Right.
So she was still stuck.
So on the 18th, she responds back.
And so why would she be penalized because it took her a day when the instructor took 3 days to get back to her to begin with? You know, your school is not usually unfair, but today's not a good day for you. But it's like you're holding tight to your policies because you pushed the student off the cliff and said, well, too bad.
You know, I don't think it's the delay that we had the issue with. It's the fact that on our side, our records did not show that she even attempted to take the exam on the 19th and the 20th.
Because she couldn't get into the exam. I don't know how many times I've been saying that.
I'm not an IT expert. I just know that we checked with our IT team.
She's completely saying, here, I can't get in. And then your people are saying, okay, well, I can't do anything more. Go to IT. And then IT says, well, maybe it's the server. We don't know. Again, I don't know. I just think it's...
Can I say something?
Who's this?
Oh, this is Marie. Taylor is on the phone right now. She was able to get on.
Hi, Marie. Yes, go ahead. You're okay. We'll say something.
So I hear what, I'm sorry, I forget her name, what she's saying, but clearly my daughter did try and get on. Like what you're saying, just because it doesn't reflect IT-wise, that doesn't mean she didn't do it. Because why wouldn't she do it?
Is this a ground student or an online student?
Ground.
Must be a hybrid course or something.
Maybe she is.
She was carrying an A in that class. Why wouldn't she take the test?
Yeah, that's a good point that Mr. Jacobs has asked. I know if you didn't hear that, but because this course, if she's on ground, you said, then apparently she's here in Arizona, right, Phoenix?
Correct. I'm a ground student, but it was an online class.
Okay. At that point, though, when you were having so much trouble and you knew time was, because you definitely knew that there's a finite amount of time, did you ever drive to the school to try to get this result?
I was
late.
Well, I live on campus. I was on campus trying to get it
resolved.
So I was on campus trying to get it resolved.
Oh.
Did you provide us any of that, TC?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What do you want? Well, just I don't see it outlined that. I was physically went to here and there. But
where do you go? I mean, it's Christmas. It's Christmas break. You're calling IT. They can't help you. School's closed for holiday. Where do you go?
I'm wondering why the professor didn't reach out to IT and wonder if there was something wrong with the system.
Yeah, I'm not for a minute laying this out on TC. I'm just. Oh, not at all. I feel this is where I'm at. Management. What do you want to go all the way up?
Well, I guess my frustration is that normally we would then have a conversation with the people who have these departments to say, you understand how your end is played fairly.
Right.
So while you followed the letter of it, you certainly did follow the spirit of it. And then we have a conversation about, are you willing to reconsider it? You're not in a position to do that.
Right.
So I don't feel right saying we're just going to give you a letter because you did a poor job of it.
Good point.
And the student is still harmed.
You defer and make sure the student comes back.
You can hold this over to another complaint committee.
Kick it up.
Or you can kick it up to the full board.
Which would get the student the quicker the satisfaction?
Board.
Okay.
You don't meet again until June. The board could be
May. I think we need to get her satisfaction sooner than that.
I do too.
And obviously, if in the meantime somebody cooler heads prevailed and they looked at it and decided that perhaps the denials appeal should not have been had, then of course it would go a little smoother.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
We're going to request that this go up to the board.
Okay.
And at that time, the appropriate people who can discuss what this needs to be at the meeting.
Sure.
Or call in, it is fine. And then in between, the school reviewed this and determined that perhaps that one of these first or second appeals should have been approved, that obviously that would mean by the time the board was already resolved.
Sure.
Do you have any reason or information why it wasn't approved the first time, and how many of your of situations like this are the appeal is approved, or and do you what do you take into account? Do you take into account the student's record and academic?
We do, and actually, this is not the first time that this has happened with the student. Back in July 6, 2016, she also claimed technical issues on a prior exam. We gave her the benefit of the doubt at that point and let her complete the exam, which she did. We keep detailed records of when anybody reaches out to IT. You know, our systems record anytime a student even logs in to attempt an exam, and we didn't have any of those records, even on the 19th or the 20th. We didn't have any tickets from her, you know, from IT's side that she reached out to IT. We don't have any communication that she reached out to the faculty member saying, I still can't get into this exam. We took all of those factors into consideration.
Did you have records that she, does she have to log into the class and then log into the exam? Do you know?
That I don't know.
See, we need that person here.
There's a whole bunch of
And I'm just getting, this just throwing it out there. If she's a campus-based student and she's having IT problems, and is the school closed during Christmas, during what period of time?
IT's always available.
IT's always available.
So yeah. That she was still on campus even
and
though...
She tried to handle it on campus too.
So did she go physically to IT?
That's what you said, yes. I asked that question.
And I guess, but then why is IT saying they don't have any
Well, I
for
guess
it?
The question is, do they create a ticket if somebody physically shows up? Because
well,
some
Well, I don't know, but we have correspondence from them too.
I've gone into IT at other schools where they just kind of tinker with your stuff and try and fix it right there. They don't create a whole work order.
Okay. Yeah, I get there's it. A, I think I'd like to wrestle this to back, though, because, again, it's a I agree with my colleague. The general issue for me today, and I think you've done a wonderful job, and you've done your job, but you're not these people that can answer these questions,
sure.
Which is one of my biggest issues with today, which I'm really surprised, because as I've said, we don't usually have this unfairness issue, this unclearness issue, and today I really saw it, and maybe not breaking statutes, but the disrespect for this committee about not even showing up with the people that can answer the questions that are in there is horribly disrespectful, and it delays a decision. So with that, I'll make a motion that we send complaint number 17-S007 to the full board for consideration for the, at the next full board meeting, at which time I direct the school to have the people that work in these specific areas that can be addressed in detail to get them to be present either via phone or in person.
Sure.
I'll second. And if we can make a comment to the student to be prepared at that meeting to have any evidence that you have. If you have the names of the people in IT you spoke to, anything you have to back up your assertion that you did attempt to do it, that would be very helpful for your case.
Do you understand that,
okay.
Casey?
Okay.
And Marie?
May I say something?
Yes.
So, you know, I did just want to point out that during the second appeal, again, we did ask her for all of that evidence, you know, we didn't maliciously and arbitrarily deny the appeal. We said, give us, you know, this is what we see on our side. If you have other documentation on your side, please, we'll take it, we'll consider it. You know, again, I don't have decision-making authority, but I imagine that if she can provide that information to us prior to the board meeting.
I guess the difficulty of that is, though, that she's, you know, it's on the last day of the test, it's going past the test, it has to be a very stressful situation.
Sure.
I personally, if it were me, I don't think I would have thought, oh, I need to cover my rear end here and make sure I get all this documentation. So honestly, the fact that she doesn't have it doesn't mean it didn't happen, and I feel like you guys are being like the big bear on the mouse here.
Sure, I understand that. But, you know, even an email to faculty or an email to IT or, you know, an IT record, anything, we don't have that on our end. So
I have that.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, we have
I
all that.
I have messages between my professor and I had messaged her over Blackcloud over the individual forum as soon as I got kicked out of the exam on the Tuesday before it was due. And I also have the IT ticket number.
Yeah, we have that, but again, for purposes, I think we're getting off track with the discussion. We do have a motion and a second on the table. All we're saying, TC, is be prepared again when we, you go to the full board, which you'll either attend in person, or the, which is in when?
April.
Fourth Thursday in April.
Anyway, you'll be notified, but just be prepared. And at this time, I think we'll call for a vote.
Okay.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. The ayes have it, no nays, no abstentions. Thank you, and we'll see you there.
Thank you.
With company.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Let me know if something changes.
Well, you know, again, if I take it back to them, they're going to say, just, you know, we want more documentation. So if, is that something that you can provide to us if you receive it from her?
I'll send anything she sends me, but it doesn't sound like she's, I think she gave us everything.
I think we had everything she wanted.
But always communicate, you know, with Marie Morse. That's the first time I've heard from TC.
Okay. Yeah, if you receive anything,
okay,
please send it.
I will, for sure. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to the next item on the agenda, number 5, call to the public. Anybody want to speak? Hearing none, we'll move on to item 6, which is adjournment. We are in adjournment at 3:24.